Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next in the series of the faculty lectures. This is fabulous. What a fabulous turnout. Today, Farha Ghanem will be speaking on Gidan Filmidan, Reflections on Masculinity and the Use of Violence in the Egyptian Revolution. And to introduce her today is her colleague from Sociology and Anthropology, Sarah Willie LeBreton. Good afternoon, friends. It's a pleasure to introduce my colleague, Dr. Farha Ghanem, Associate Professor of Anthropology. I'd like to begin, however, with a very brief tribute to my dissertation advisor, Arlene Kaplan Daniels, who died last week at the age of 81. She advised Joy Charlton and me a few years later while we were graduate students at Northwestern University. Arlene was a force to be reckoned with, an outstanding feminist, an ally to other marginalized groups, and finally, an anthropologist's sociologist. By that I mean she was a qualitative sociologist of no mean ability. Her love of people, their depths and contradictions, their fortitudes and weaknesses kept her going even when she was discouraged from completing graduate school because she was married, banned from tenure-track jobs because she was female, and finally, nearly 15 years after she received her doctorate, had to take a job outside of the state with the most robust public higher education system of the time, California, and 1,000 miles away from her husband, in order to fulfill her dream of being a tenured sociologist. I think it's meaningful to mention Arlene Daniels in memoriam because she's a reminder for me that there's nothing to fear in the scholarly work of scientific and artistic exploration, even when it is on a group of subjects that one is not supposed to study. Her last book, Invisible Careers, was about women who were upper class and Protestant and whose work was in the volunteer world. They were not people for whom Dr. Daniels was supposed to study or to respect, or whose common sense told her would respect her as a Jewish woman with quote-unquote too much education who worked for a living. Dr. Farha Ghanem takes us today into the world of Arab men, not people for whom, as a feminist scholar, she has been expected to study and treat seriously. But like Arlene Kaplan Daniels before her, Farha Ghanem is a fearless anthropologist, a sociologist anthropologist, because she goes into the modern and the postmodern and the industrialized urban spaces. For those of you who do not know Professor Ghanem, she is a native of Jordan, though she is on the eve of becoming an American citizen. In Jordan, she earned a bachelor's of journalism and mass communication and then went on to earn a master's in social anthropology, both from Yarmouk University. Her doctorate in anthropology is from the University of Texas at Austin. I find it important that her undergraduate work began in observation and recording, the kind of careful observation and recording that is central to a democratic society. I also find it important that her desire for depth and mastery of, frankly, swimming upstream in the deep and rock-infested waters of culture led her to what I consider to be the preeminent discipline in the deciphering of social meaning, anthropology. Professor Ghanem has been a prolific scholar, behaving as if she were at a research university, with two articles that were published last year, another coming out this year, in the preeminent journal of her discipline, The American Ethnologist. Her entry, Egypt, will grace the pages of the Gale Group's forthcoming Worldmark Encyclopedia. She has two edited volumes under her belt, her first single-authored monograph, Remaking the Modern, published by the University of California Press in 2002, and she is now completing a second single-authored volume, To Live and Die Like a Man, under contract with Stanford University Press. Farha's earlier work on urban space was, she told me, shaped by national and international discourses, social inequalities, and an attempt to get at how people work and rework their spaces. The link between Remaking the Modern and her current work is still with space, but honing down to a consideration of the body itself as the space with which one reckons. According to Dr. Ghanem, while men were at one point the only object of study in the Middle East, and just that, objects of study in the colonial imagination, next came a focus on women, a more nuanced focus, and one that broke intellectual boundaries. A return to a reconceptualized understanding of embodiment and masculinity had not yet become a priority for scholars, Farha acknowledges, and so she came to this project almost by accident,
after being intellectually distracted, in Tausig's sense of the word, by a religious audio tape circulated in Cairo in the late 1990s that focused on young men and how their sexual desires might be managed and controlled. For Farhat, the space or spaces of the body are no less worked and reworked by social processes and cultural discourses than are the spaces of the city. Today, Farhat Ghanam finds herself theorizing how urban life as a thing itself, she's taken the study of the city to places Emile Durkheim never could have anticipated, how urban life participates in shaping people's identities, but also their gendered identities and bodies, and particularly the bodies and spaces and strictures and options of and for men. The most recent social and political transformation in Egypt and the rest of the quote-unquote Middle East, for all of the problems with conceiving of this place, these places as geographic and social monoliths, this political transformation enlightens her own research, she insists, predicts it and is predicted by it. But prediction is my word, the conceit and distraction of sociologists. Understanding, however, is the goal of our allied colleagues in anthropology, and understanding is anthropologist Farhat Ghanam's forte. The list of Professor Ghanam's awards, honors, and fellowships is lengthy, as is the list of service that she does for the college, the Tri-College Consortium, my own department, the programs in gender and sexuality studies, Islamic studies, the Arabic program in modern languages and literatures for her students and on various college-wide committees. You might only imagine what last year was like for her as newspaper after radio show after student group asked again and again for her insight and opinion during the unfolding of what has come to be known as Arab Spring. Although she had anticipated a quiet sabbatical, her generous spirit encouraged her to engage in this public anthropology. For that, for her insights, her good teaching, her courage, her kindness, and her intellectual acumen, we are all so fortunate. Please join me in welcoming Farhat Ghanam.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm honored to have all of you here. Thank you, Sarah, for the very nice introduction. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate all the support that you and the department offers me. In particular, I'd like to thank Rosmayo for her everyday support in every possible way. Without her, life would have been very, very difficult, if at all possible. I'd like to thank also my anthropology writing group, Christy Schutze, Maya Nakardani, Liz Brown. Oh, there you are. Okay. And most recently, Lizzie Falcone. I should say that they've been a tremendous help for me, especially last year when I was in sabbatical. They kept me organized, and their support and reading of my drafts have been invaluable. I'd like to thank all my students who inspire me every single day, and I get so much energy from them. I really appreciate that. All of you have been terrific. In particular, I'd like to thank Alison Stu, Sierra Eckert, Bernard Herman, and Lindsay Dolan. Thank you all for all your help and support in many different ways. And also, I would like to thank the college for financially supporting the research and the writing, and the Ford Foundation for supporting my research. And I'm sure I'm forgetting lots of people, but I want to end the thank you note by thanking my daughter, Lena, who is here today. She's old enough to be in this talk, and I'm very proud of that. And I thank Lena not only because she's been part of my research, and she came with me to Cairo when I was there on sabbatical for a year, but because she puts up with mom's endless number of hours of work. So thank you, Lena. You know why I work so hard now, I hope. So as Sarah was saying, it was almost 6 months into my sabbatical, and I was very happily writing when suddenly major transformation started happening in Egypt. And for a moment at least, I had this moment of panic. Is anything I'm saying and I'm writing about relevant anymore? And I honestly almost was paralyzed for a little while with that feeling, except that had it not been for my writing group and for all the other people who were asking me questions about what has been happening, which actually made me realize that, in fact, what I was saying was extremely relevant. So today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the connections that were not intended beforehand, but how, in fact, anthropological work may help us understand something about the political, social transformation that are shaping the Middle East in general and Egypt in particular. And today I'm not going to talk, I mean, of course, I'm tempted to talk about the whole book, but I'm going to limit my discussion to one aspect of it, and I'll be open for any questions you may have. So all of us have been following, I think, the tremendous success of the January 25th, 2011 Egyptian protest. And these protests, in fact, have captured the imagination of scholars, activists, and journalists who have been eager to understand the forces that facilitated the mobilization, the unexpected, actually, mobilization. That was the interesting thing. Even the activists did not expect this kind of mobilization. So how do we make sense out of that? So scholars, when they when they try to analyze what happened in Egypt, they pay attention to, of course, lots of important issues such as the Tunisian Revolution, social media, you know, Facebook in particular and Twitter have been highlighted, economic marginalization, political corruption, and the effect of collaboration between different social and political groups. And these are, of course, all very important aspects for us to think about, even though, you know, we could problematize perhaps all this emphasis on Facebook and so on, which I could talk about later, but not at this moment. Yet, for me, what has been really missing has been how structures of feeling have been shaped by the interplay between local cultural meanings and values and broader national struggles and events. The phrase structures of feeling was advanced by Raymond Williams to capture the interplay between the social and personal, objective and subjective, fixed and active, explicit and implicit, and thought and feeling. Williams chose the word feeling in particular to emphasize a distinction from more formal concepts of worldview and ideology, and to highlight the need to account not only for formally held and systematic beliefs, but also for meanings and values as they are actively lived and felt, and the relations between these and formal or systematic beliefs. So although social media, the media in general actually, allowed us, especially those who were outside of Egypt, to closely follow and virtually participate in major events, especially in Midan al-Tahrir or Liberation Square, we have little knowledge of how these events were interpreted on the one hand by Egyptians and how they shaped, informed the interpretations and feelings of ordinary Egyptians and their stance toward the revolution and the Mubarak era. Today, I would like to trace the shifting feelings of some of my close interlocutors in Zaya al-Hamra, a low-income neighborhood, if this works. Oh, yes, okay. A low-income neighborhood in northern Cairo, where I have been working for the past 18 years, and explore some of the cultural concepts and meanings that informed their attempts to make sense out of the changing events during the first days of the revolution. Specifically, I would like to reflect on how existing categories and concepts that regulate and structure uses of violence in this neighborhood have been central to the ways men and women interpreted the actions of the protesters and their opponents in Midan al-Tahrir. These interpretations ultimately frame their views of the revolution, Mubarak's regime, and its supporters. So all of us remember the January 25th, 2011, when the event started in Midan al-Tahrir and how they started building up. So my discussion is going to actually be just focused on the first few days of these protests. And I want to trace with you how the feelings of the residents of this neighborhood, or some of them that I know, shifted. So knowing about their frequently negative encounters with the government and its agents, especially the police, the economic hardships that structure their daily lives, their political marginalization, and the history of protest movements in this neighborhood, I expected people in Zawi al-Hamra to immediately and fully embrace the cause for social and economic justice. I thought this is about them, you know, about the daily life that they were leading. However, during the first few days, the families I talked to over the phone, and I should say that, of course, these are not Twitter users or, you know, Facebook users. They didn't have access to any of the social media, and the only way I could communicate with them was the phone, which is a very interesting technology that I think we tend to forget about in light of all this fascination with social media. But talking to them, you know, there was a sense of uncertainty about what was happening that they always expressed. And they were not sure about how long the demonstrations would last and who the protesters even were. Who are these people? We have no idea who they are. The residents, especially daily workers and families with no savings, felt unsafe and worried about their livelihoods. They blamed the protesters for disrupting their access to work, threatening their safety, and destabilizing the country. Because of the government censorship, many were largely limited to watching TV channels that supported official lines of argumentation. They thought poorly of the activists and used the lines offered by government propaganda, describing the protesters as troublemakers who were paid a daily allowance in euros by outsiders and who were served free meals from Kentucky Fried Chicken. And you know, the symbolism of Kentucky Fried Chicken is actually very meaningful here because it was indicating that they are really pro-Westerners. They ate Western food and used their money to destabilize the country. These feelings were especially strong in the immediate aftermath of an emotional speech by Mubarak on February 1st. I think some of you may remember that. In which, in that speech, he warned against potential chaos and disorder generated by the demonstrations. He promised that he would neither run again for the presidency nor pass his position to his son, and declared that he had served Egypt for most of his life and would like to die and be buried in the soil of Egypt. This speech moved many people in Zawiya who fully supported the president and his plans for change. In fact, they never dreamed that he would get to that point. They felt that he was offering major concessions and that the protesters would be unreasonable if they refused to give him a chance to finish his term in September 2011. And their feelings and views, however, changed rapidly after the attacks on the demonstrators on Liberation Square on February 2nd. So during the 18 days, I'm talking about between January 25th and February 11th, during these days that led to the removal of Mubarak, Midan al-Tahrir was transformed into an epicenter of a moral geography that connected Egyptians in different locations into the same political and ethical project. And I could talk a lot about the Midan al-Tahrir and its centrality, its, the significance of its history, and significance in the broader imaginary of Cairo, but I don't think there will be time for us here to do that. I think the important point to emphasize is that the Midan's spatial centrality and its historical significance enabled millions of Egyptians to come together as citizens who shared pressing grievances and demands. Despite initial clashes with the police, the demonstrators continued to grow in numbers, and the police withdrew in January 28th to be replaced by members of the army who declared that they would not shoot at the protesters. So, you know, the army was welcomed, actually, when they appeared in Cairo Street. That is, you know, the first few days. So everybody was optimistic that, you know, things are going to be peaceful and things will work out. Remember, I talked about the speech that Mubarak gave on February 1st, and everybody was very sympathetic. Exactly on February 2nd, we have so-called Mubarak supporters attacking the Midan. Okay. So we start having these, I think many of us did follow with a tremendous horror, at least in my case, as men riding horses and camels attack the square, wielding stones, whips, clubs, knives, sticks, firebombs, and even guns against peaceful protesters. These attackers were immediately seen by many Egyptians, including people in Zawiya, as Baltagiyya, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. That is thugs who were commissioned by government officials to frighten the demonstrators. And after several days of attacks and people getting injured, we were trying to protect themselves with all the means they had. We start seeing the protesters erecting fences around Midan al-Tahrir to protect themselves. And during that period, they actually showed tremendous courage, and they managed to chase the attackers away and to erect the fences to protect the area. My interlocutors' narratives and media coverage clearly mark these attacks and the successful defense of Tahrir Square as among the most important moments in the recent revolution. The assaults played a central role in the transformation of views of politicians, artists, intellectuals, movie stars, and members of the elite, but at the same time, ordinary residents like people in Zawi al-Hamra. The attacks brought to the foreground the set of associations between the past and the present, the local and the national, and the proper and improper uses of violence that shaped in powerful ways the views many Egyptians held of the protesters and the pro-Mubarak supporters. So over the past decade, and as Sarah was saying, my interest in masculinity, violence has become an important part of my ethnographic research. And as argued by many other scholars in different parts of the world, not only in the Middle East, but, you know, globally, including the U.S., there is a strong relationship between the construction, the social construction of masculinity and the use of violence. While violence is not a privilege in itself, it is part of the practice by which particular men or groups of men claim respect, intimidate rivals, or try to gain material advantages. Similarly, in Zawiya, men are expected to use violence both inside and outside the home to assert their standing as men. I have a very elaborate discussion of this issue of violence, and I wish I could go in a lot of depth in it, because it's a very important topic, in particular when it comes to the Middle East, where the myth of the violent Middle Eastern man is so incredibly common and is very central to the dehumanization of Middle Eastern men. I wish I could perhaps talk much more about this, but I wanted to highlight a few points about the use of violence in this neighborhood, and perhaps later we could elaborate a bit more on, in particular, how this myth plays itself in the U.S. and how it's used to policing, monitoring, torturing, and excluding Arab men. So I'll make just a few points before I move to link this to the revolution. If you look at violence in daily life in a neighborhood like Zawi al-Hamra, the first thing to note, it's not arbitrary, okay? It's not something unstructured, but rather there are ethical codes and mechanisms in place that aim to contain and regulate its use. Right. So this is the first point. The second point is, actually violence is a social practice. It is an exercise of power that is productive. That is to say, notice I'm saying productive and not saying positive, okay? Productive in the sense it could produce results, it could produce effects, it could produce the kind of categories that it aims to only describe. So, you know, a real man, for instance, you know, the category real man is tied to a particular deployment of violence in certain contexts. That is to say, it's actually selective, okay? Its selective deployment creates the subjects that it claims to simply represent. I would like to highlight the idea selective, okay? Because, in fact, a man who is unselective about using violence, who uses it very frequently and in an unmeasured way, could totally be undermined as a man, all right? So for it to be effective, it has to be measured, infrequent, and used in its proper context. These are important points to keep in mind for my following discussion. At the same time, there is a strong connection between the legitimate use of violence and upholding cherished social norms, on the one hand, and reinforcing the hierarchies that structure relationships between men and women, old and young, parent and child, citizen and state. Okay. The ability of others, this is the last point I'm making here, a broad point, the ability of others to monitor, classify, judge, and attach meanings to various violent acts, as well as the fact that they are expected, people are expected, in fact obliged to interfere to stop the use of force, is key to the regulation and management of violence both at home and outside. So there is an ethical code that regulates how, when violence is used, an ethical code that makes it actually a public act that everybody should be involved in, even strangers, in particular to stop it and to contain it. More broadly, if you look closely at the daily use of violence, you'll find that people clearly make a distinction between proper, improper, legitimate, illegitimate uses of violence, and this is incredibly significant for my presentation today. So I'm going to focus in particular in two categories that are significant in Zawi al-Hamra that became nationally very significant, and that is the concept of Gad'ana and Baltaga. Okay, I'm going to elaborate much more on them in a minute. But Gad'ana and Baltaga are concepts that differentiate, commend and condemn different uses of violence and how they relate to specific contexts and social inequalities. The interesting thing about these two concepts is that the events in Tahrir and how the protesters carried themselves actually occupied these existing categories very well. So whereas the rebels or Siwar, you know, the protesters, had proven themselves to be Gad'an, the first concept, you know, related to Gad'ana, brave and decent men and women willing to sacrifice their lives for the dignity and good of the whole nation, Mubarak's government and supporters were seen as Baltagiya. Don't worry, I'm going to elaborate on this in a minute, okay? Don't feel you have to absorb all of this. This is actually a very meaningful discussion, so let me start by elaborating on the notion of Gada. What happened to my beautiful Arabic writing? Okay, it looked much better at home, and in the office too. I was trying to impress you that I could use, you know, Arabic in PowerPoint, so much for that. Okay. But if you look at the slide, you see that you know, we have the adjective gada'ana, then one is gada', and then there is gada'an, the plural. And the gada' basically refers to a person who excels in materializing social norms that define the moral universe of Egyptian popular classes, including intelligence, valor, toughness, reliability, and decency. As in other popular Sha'bi quarter areas in Egypt, in Cairo, in Zawi, the adjective gada'ana refers to a mix of gallantry and nobility, audacity, responsibility, generosity, vigor, and manliness. A gada is a person who does not accept injustice or tyranny and usually stands for the weak against the strong. In Zawiya, where I do my research, parents strongly desire their sons and daughters, for that matter, to be gida'an, to be supportive and assertive, but without oppressing others. من غير ما يفتروا على حد. Part of gada'ana is not to resort to violence except in its proper context, including self-defense, aiding friends and relatives, and protecting vulnerable individuals and family members, especially female family members. It is important to note that not all men are gida'an, and not all gida'an are men. A woman or a boy who materializes key aspects of gida'ana could acquire the symbolic label. A woman who is firm, savvy about traveling, wise about spending money, and capable of asserting herself in front of others, especially men, is referred to as gada'a, which is the feminine of gada'a. So action, not gender, determines who deserves this label and who does not. This concept is actually to be contrasted with the concept of baltagi. Okay? So in contrast to the gada, a baltagi is someone, usually a man, who uses violence to impose his own will on others and to further his personal interest. This concept has a long history that goes back as far as the Ottomans, but it was reinvented by the Egyptian government in recent times to control what it termed social terrorism. I'm talking about the Mubarak, basically, government. Whereas in the late 1980s and early 1990s, government representatives and journalists used the phrase mainly to refer to Islamist leaders. Since the mid-1990s, social baltaga primarily referred to the violence that erupted between government agents and young men in popular quarters. So this is basically was an attempt from the government to control young men and their movements. So they issued actually a law, law number 6, which is in thuggery, how to regulate thugs. It was passed in 1998 to regulate behavior deemed antisocial and threatening, and proposed stiff penalties for acts thought to intimidate others. This law granted security forces, here is the secret, this law granted security forces extensive powers to stop, search, question, and detain individuals suspected of threatening order and security. So it became this incredibly broad thing that was used mainly to brutalize and harass and regulate and discipline young men. Central to this process has been the control of various spaces, such as streets, mosques, and local markets, and their use, especially by young men. At the same time, and this is really a key point to remember, baltagiya were appropriated as useful tools of the police. So the police start recruiting these baltagiya, training them, and paying them to counter protests, you know, protests wherever they emerge, scare opposition groups, intimidate voters, during elections especially, and generate a sense of chaos that justifies the need for heavy policing of various spaces and groups. So, you know, the more baltagiya are out there, the more you need police to counter them and to control the streets and so on. Unlike this understanding, which tended to lump young men together as potential baltagiya, the definition of baltaga in Zawiya focuses mainly on the improper uses of violence in daily life. Contrary to the gada, who aims to help and protect others, a baltagi is a person who uses force to bully others, take over their property, extract money from them, or coerce them to comply with his wishes. He does not work to further the public good or serve the community, but is focused on his own well-being, and his loyalties are easily bought, and you know, so you could in fact hire a thug who could do certain things for you, and so on. In addition to his conduct, both his weapon, and I find this really interesting in terms of my work on embodiment. So his weapon, which is usually a kind of singa, it's called singa, it's a long knife that's usually held very visible because that's what you want. You want to intimidate people, so it has to be visible. Unlike the other weapons that young men may carry, like small knives, that they usually hide very discreetly and they don't take it out unless there is a needed. And also his appearance, in particular, the way he dresses, but also the visible scars on his face that signify to others that I'm a tough guy, I've been in fights, and I'm not afraid of confrontation. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of young men, when they get into fights, they want to protect the face, they don't want it to be scarred, because that would be interpreted as a sign of baltaga. So for people in Zawiya, these, you know, the bodily hexes, you know, the bodily signs, as well as the weapon, was what signified to them, as well as, of course, the conduct, who was a baltagi. So through their own observations and the testimonies of relatives and neighbors, people are usually able to recognize who is socially defined as a baltagi in their community and work to either avoid, control, or defeat them. This distinction between baltagi and gada became particularly relevant during the recent, the 18 days that I was talking about, and they strongly shaped the shifting feelings of my interlocutors in Zawiya. The conduct of the protesters, which at first was suspicious, you know, the people were very suspicious of and they negatively viewed, became over time legitimized and equated with notions of gada'ana. All right. Well, at the same time, the conduct of Mubarak and his supporters, which was sort of, you know, in a little bit considered legitimate or possibly legitimate, became actually more delegitimized and part of the notion of baltaga. Notions of gada'ana became clearly articulated both in Zawiya and Midan al-Tahrir at the same time. In particular, the fact that the occupiers of both spaces worked in parallel ways to aid, protect, support, and contain violence generated both emotional and political connections that linked them to the same moral and political project. The mobilization of people in Zawiya against the potential threat of baltagiyya was particularly significant. So what happened, if you remember, when I was talking about January 28th, that's when the police withdrew from the streets and a huge number of criminals was either released or escaped, it depends who's telling the story, from prisons. And that generated a tremendous sense of fear and uncertainty. The police station on the in January 28th, not only in Zawiya but in other places too, they were burned down, and so, you know, everybody basically felt very insecure and scared. In particular, because there were these rumors that threatening that baltagiyya from different areas are going to come and get you. So, you know, people, when I was in Zawiya in 2011, December 2011, they were like, you know, we thought they were going to come and attack us, and they thought we were going to go and attack them. So, you know, there was that feeling, we are under threat and they are under threat at the same time. So there was this context that generated the mobilization of the men in this particular neighborhood who formed groups to defend the neighborhood and their families against potential attacks. So they formed groups and armed themselves with batons, bottles, knives, and hoses. They stayed up day and night and worked together to watch over their streets, monitor cars, check identities, clean streets, and offer basic services. This period both reflected and reinforced a strong sense of camaraderie and solidarity, and at the same time materialized the kind of masculine ethos that are very highly regarded in this neighborhood, you know, about protecting, aiding, providing, bravery, assertiveness, and so on. Going through the fears, if you think about the neighborhood, going through the fears, the worries, and the risk of protecting their neighborhood, it was not difficult for many people in Zawiya to increasingly identify with the protesters who were also subjected to the violence of baltagiyya, especially on February 2nd, as I showed you the slides before. Just as Zawiya's residents attempted to defend and care for their neighborhood, those in the square also protected it, cleaned it, and offered emotional, medical, and material support to its occupants. So I'll just show you a little bit of a few slides here. The internet is great in that sense. You know, if I have any complaints about it, it's not definitely that. That's a great thing. If you check the BBC Interactive website, it's fantastic because it just shows you how the square was organized. And if you look here, I mean, it really, to my mind, it became like a little city within the big city. and you find so many different things that were happening there, in clinics, different clinics in different parts of it. The bloggers, they had their section and they were broadcasting the news to different people who were getting married in Tahrir. They were very proud of that. Barber actually volunteered his time. He really wanted to cut people's hair there. This is during the 18 days, huh? Because he thought people should good, look good. Sleeping and protecting it, protecting in different ways, including sleeping and in the tanks. Music, I wish I had the time to talk about that, but maybe later. Cleaning it, beautifying the square was a very important, significant part of how the protesters not only wanted to keep the environment clean, but they were creating a space that countered the broader ineffectiveness, irresponsibility of the government. So, for instance, trash has been a major problem in a city like Cairo. Neither the government, not even the French, managed to solve that problem in Cairo, because the government's like, we can't handle it, let's give it to private French companies, and they couldn't do that. So, so I think the protesters, through their work, they were really trying to counter that by creating a view of the kind of future that they were aspiring to and were hoping to materialize after Mubarak. And of course, this is part of the celebrations that took place in Tahrir after Mubarak decided, forced to leave. So through such parallel actions and emotional connections, the protesters were redefined as Gid'an and national heroes, well-educated, reliable, and trustworthy young men who are willing to sacrifice financial success and easy living to advocate for freedom and social justice. Their mawaqif, or stands, attitudes, showed the type of rugula, or masculinity, that is highly regarded in Zawiya. A sharp ethical contrast was created between these cherished heroes, who avoided the use of violence as much as possible, but who were brave enough, that's the key here, to defend themselves and protect Tahrir Square. And the Baltadi, so on the one hand, you have these heroes who were assertive, brave, did not resort to violence, and you have, on the other hand, the Baltagiya, who unjustly used violence against peaceful protesters for the sole purpose of defending the interests of few corrupt politicians. Whereas the occupants of Tahrir represented the nation's aspirations for a brighter future, the acts of Baltaga became closely linked to the state and its arbitrary use of violence. And this is a major difference, that the state has been using violence very arbitrarily, but that was a moment that articulated that very nicely to the people. Its habit of breaking its promises and the tendency to use illegitimate means to serve the interests of a small minority at the expense of the whole nation. As one of my female interlocutors in Zawiya, who was originally very moved by Mubarak's speech, told me, the president was making all these promises and asking people to trust him, and the next thing we hear about is the attacks in Tahrir. How does he expect us to believe him after that? She critically reflected on her earlier emotional reaction and strong support for Mubarak after his speech, and explained to me that almost all her relatives and neighbors felt as they did, as she did, because they are atufin, kind-hearted and forgiving. They truly believed the president's promises and wanted to give him another chance. However, by the summer of 2011, she insisted that the protesters were right. She praised them for not accepting Mubarak's empty promises and for insisting on their demands. She detailed with dread the terrible consequences that could have resulted had Mubarak stayed in power. At the same time, the events in Tahrir Square and in Zawiya clearly confirmed what many had known and believed for a long time about the illegitimate use of force by state agents. Samir, a worker in his early 40s, argued that, like Baltagiya, the police used force to obtain illegitimate payments, especially bribes, to enable the government to extract tax and enabled the government to extract taxes from ordinary citizens. So he actually thought the taxes they were forced to pay were very comparable to the money that the Baltagiya was asking people for, because they were not really giving them anything in return, and at the same time they were forced to give. They were not willingly giving it. In fact, he concluded, not only had the previous government used Baltagiya to intimidate its political opponents and its officials, but its officials themselves were also Baltagiya, because they used the techniques of Baltaga. That's really important. So, they become Baltagiya themselves. Not only they hired Baltagiya, but they are also Baltagiya themselves. And this stunning magnitude of the corruption, the kind of corruption and the brutality of the police, and the amount of force that it used continues to be now one of the key factors that people are rallying around and are using to make an, to support the revolution on the one hand and make an argument against the previous revolution, the regime. Thus, the figure of the Baltagi, utilized by Mubarak's government to control youth and their spatial mobilities, became central to the discourse that strongly condemned that government's actions undermined its legitimacy and framed the anti-regime feelings of many Egyptians. Okay. Over the past year, the threat of Baltagiyya have become a major public concern in Egypt, as well as a significant discursive tool in the struggle over the legitimacy and visibility. When I visited Zawiya in July of 2011, all of my interlocutors were concerned about Baltagiyya and the threat they posed to them and to others. Stories circulated about the kidnapping of people for ransom, the theft of cars, the snatching of handbags and jewelry from women, even during daylight. This is totally unheard of in the context of Cairo, so this is a major disturbing change for them. Even the shooting of police officers and the beating of ordinary citizens, even their death. Such events were usually taking place in other neighborhoods had a strong emotional impact on residents in Zawiya. So, you know, sometimes they would check and say, nobody would kidnap us because we have no money, so we are not worried about that at all, you know. But at the same time, there was this fear and this uncertainty that was reflected in small things, like, for instance, how they start adding more locks to the door, how they start to the big building having an outside door that would be locked at night, which was not the case at all before the proliferation of these Baltagiyya. Whereas such criminal acts like, you know, snatching someone's jewelry or handbag or kidnapping and so on are easily classified by people as acts of Baltaga, over the past few months, the concept has become more ambiguous, contested, and politicized. And I think maybe many of you have seen it and heard it in so many different venues. The media report daily accusations and counter-accusations of Baltaga, and different groups use this term to discredit their opponents. So the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which is the ruling, which is ruling Egypt now, has been using the term Baltaga in various contexts to assert its power and to delegitimize the actions of others. Others here is becoming a broad, very broad and shifting category that includes but goes beyond the protesters. So, you know, who are the others is shifting every day. You know, it depends on what the army has in mind that day or, you know, the council. The council reactivated the Thuggery law, which gave them tremendous power in detaining and severely punishing a wide range of individuals. Many have been critical of the ways in which the Supreme Council uses this term, the term Baltagiyya and Baltaga. Activists in particular have been disapproving of the tendency of the council to use the term to negatively portray those who defy its orders and to discredit Tahrir Square protesters and turn their image from Suwar, you know, or rebels, revolutionaries, to Baltagiyya or thugs. Many have used such accusations as an indication of continuities between the current and the previous regimes, claiming that acts of Baltaga are deliberately commissioned by the supporters of a counter-revolution to undermine the accomplishments of the January 25th revolution. In short, Baltagiyya have become sort of the masked actors. It's like what the government likes to call the hidden hands. You know, these are hidden, mysterious hands that are trying to ruin the country and cultivate fear and chaos. To further complicate this picture, while originally the protesters in Midan Tahrir and other parts of Egypt wanted to distance themselves from Baltagiyya and from the notion of Baltaga, most recently they actually started appropriating the concept in an ironic sort of way to say, if you think that, you know, revolutionary acts are Baltaga, then we are going to become Baltagiyya. We are proud of being Baltagiyya, which I think is an interesting move, but at the same time, I'm not sure how successful it's going to be in terms of speaking to the sensibilities of people like the resident of Zawiya al-Hamra, where I think the concept has very specific meanings. So it will be interesting to see how this will evolve. But the multiple and contradictory uses. So here, by the way, yes, here is a T-shirt that the protesters have been using in Cairo, and it's written in Arabic, you know, one Baltagi and one Baltagiyya. So one is male Baltagi and one is female Baltagiyya. It's actually interesting because usually Baltagi is a male, so it's not really used to refer to women, but in this case they are trying to subvert that too and try to use it. So we'll see where that's going to take us. The multiple and contradictory use of this term in several contexts and for different purposes have made it more complicated for the public to judge whether those accused of baltaga by politicians and media actually had anything to do, have done anything illegitimate. My interlocutors in Izzawiya tended to listen to different opinions and then use their own judgment to evaluate such accusations. So now the burden is actually on the person to decide for themselves who is the baltaga and who is not. They closely observe the type of act committed, its location, the accused groups and their history, the accusers and their relationship to the previous and current regime, and the TV images, including the dress code and the accused, and the dress code of the accused and the accuser. For example, while we were watching news of the clashes next to the Ministry of Defense in Abbasiya, you may remember in July 2011, there was a move from Tahrir to neighborhood of Abbasiya to go to the Ministry of Defense to protest in front of it, and that was a major, actually, transformation in the revolution. So there was these different accusations. The Supreme Council claimed that those who went to Abbasiya were actually Baltagiyya, and those who went from Tahrir, were in Tahrir, they said, no, actually, these are revolutionaries like us, and they want to assert their view. So on TV, both sides are making totally exactly the opposite claims. So what the ordinary viewers were doing is look at the different, observe the different images that were circulated, in particular the facial features of those interviewed, their dress code and ways of talking, as well as the methods used to vandalize cars, stores and apartments. So now you have to really go deeper than what they're saying to try to look at the more subtle hints in the image itself and to see if that's going to give you any clues about what kind of judgment to make. So sometimes, for instance, they dismissed the claims of some of the interviewed because they did not look respectable and concluded that these who attacked, surely those who attacked beautiful apartments, nice cars and fancy-looking businesses, they can't possibly be revolutionaries, they must be baltagiyya, and they were deliberately inciting violence. Yet the political leanings, which is a very interesting change, I think, in Zawiya, the political leanings of men and women start exerting more and more influence on this process of interpretation. So while the term baltagiyya continues to refer to those who illegitimately deploy violence, local uses are increasingly linked to national accusations and discourses. Thus, those among my interlocutors who have Islamist leanings tended to follow the line of Islamist leaders who accuse those who remain in Tahrir, even now, as baltagiyya. Others who were sympathetic to the army and saw it as the source of legitimacy during this transitional period tended to accept the classification offered by the Supreme Council. To conclude, I'm going to really be very brief here. While it's premature for us perhaps to say much more about how the impact of all the contested, ambiguous nature of this concept and how it's going to redefine perhaps the categories that people use in Zawiya, I don't want to push it more than that because, as Sarah was saying, we try to understand and to try to really follow what happens rather than just speculate about it. The key point here is that people make a very clear distinction between legitimate, appropriate uses of violence and inappropriate uses of violence, and there's a very strong relationship between the kind of distinction, honor, and masculine identification that is conferred in individuals. The very last thing I would like to say is to better understand revolution in Egypt and elsewhere, scholars need to look closely at the overlaps, redefinitions, and contradictions between existing cultural forms, meanings, and values and emerging political projects, goals, and movements. As Williams intended with structures of feeling, my reflections in the notions of Baltaga and Gad'ana illustrate how such categories and concepts have shaped the interpretation of significant events and the shifting feelings and views of ordinary Egyptians, many of whom came to strongly embrace the revolution. Looking at such categories and how they overlap with events in various locations enables us to capture the lived sense of specific moments of political transformation and how connections established between thoughts and feelings, formed and emerging meanings, past and present experiences, and local and national struggles have been central to the inclusion of most Egyptians in the same political and moral project. Thank you for your patience.